Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlohm. As a kid growing up in suburban Southern California and rural Northern California, I often found myself in need of what I think of as a necessary and regular dose of nature, on scales both grand, like the dark night sky, and intimate, like a day hike or even an afternoon in my backyard. For me, the Nature Conservancy truly met that need, especially as I regularly visited a property in the Santa Monica Mountains overlooking my beloved Malibu coastline. So recently, when I ran across a story about how the Nature Conservancy is working with farmers in the Sacramento Delta region to preserve both farmland through sustainable agriculture and the multitude of birds that migrate on the Pacific Flyway through California's Sacramento Valley, I became fascinated, and I think you will be too. Our guests for this show are two scientists and a farmer. Later on, we'll visit with farmer DeWeet Zielicki about his role in helping manage the Nature Conservancy's farm property at Staten Island. Yes, there is a Staten Island in California. But first, we're going to talk to two scientists involved in a project to promote the beneficial relationship that can sustain both wildlife, especially migratory birds, and farming in the Sacramento Delta region. Rod Kelsey is a biologist and associate director of the Nature Conservancy's Water Management Program in California, which has taken on added significance during the state's dramatic drought that has lasted for more than a decade. He's joined by Kristen Dabala. She's the principal ecologist representing the environmental organization that's spearheading research from the Sierra to the Pacific Coast and beyond called Point Blue Conservation Science. Dabala and Kelsey joined me recently to talk about the cooperative effort to foster ecological balance in the Sacramento Delta. Rod Kelsey, tell us a bit about how you first came to the Nature Conservancy.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Thanks for having us. I came to the Nature Conservancy actually from the Audubon Society. I've been with the Nature Conservancy for about 8 years. And I, for many years, for over two decades now, have been working at the interface of agriculture and wildlife conservation, both with Audubon and the Nature Conservancy. And I did my PhD at UC Davis, which gave me a front row seat to the Central Valley and living in the Valley and learning about what was going on here. And that's how I ended up doing the great job I'm doing now.
Kristy Dabala, you're an ecologist. Can you tell us about, you know, how you came to be involved with the Nature Conservancy project?
Sure. Actually, so I'm an ecologist with Point Blue Conservation Science. And I got connected with them straight out of undergrad. They caught my eye as an incredible nonprofit science organization working on bird conservation in particular in California. And have since then worked a lot on conservation and restoration projects, and specifically with birds in riparian and wetland ecosystems in the Central Valley. And so through that, I got connected with Rod and the Nature Conservancy, and our organizations partner together quite a bit on this work.
Well, we're interested in talking about the Great Sacramento Valley ecosystem, which is such an integral part of California's ecology. Could you just, let me start with you, Kristy, since you're an ecologist. Tell us about, give us a big picture overview of how important, like, the Delta region and the Central and Northern Sacramento Valley are for the birds that fly on the Pacific Flyway, the waterfowl, and also the fisheries.
Sure, yeah. The Central Valley is an incredibly important place for all kinds of birds. Waterfowl, certainly, shorebirds, land birds, raptors, you name it. There's an incredible diversity of birds throughout the Central Valley and including the Delta. And, you know, the diversity is in part, I mean, we have just these birds migrating from their nesting regions up in the Arctic sometimes. And they're migrating thousands of miles down to and through the Central Valley. And when they get here, they're hungry and they're looking for suitable habitat that has their favorite foods in it. And the Central Valley has just an incredible diversity of land cover types, including wetlands and agricultural lands and riparian forests. And the diversity of that kind of mosaic of land cover types really contributes to the diversity of the bird communities that we can support.
And Rod, could you tell us a bit about the Nature Conservancy's efforts through the years in preserving areas in the valley? Because I'm familiar with some of the places in the foothills and in Southern California. But can you tell us about some of the valley places that the Nature Conservancy has over the years worked on preserving?
Yeah, our work in the valley began almost four decades ago now, and it was part of our effort to what we called at the time, protecting the last great places. And in the valley, one of those special places that we really invested a lot in and that Christy and Point Blue have also been very involved with is the Cosumnes River Preserve, which is just south of Sacramento. And we began protecting that for the last remnants of these old growth valley oak forests that were there. And we quickly started learning how important both the Cosumnes River and its associated floodplains are, for fish and migratory birds, as well as how important the agriculture that is there and has replaced a lot of those natural habitats that once existed in the valley. And so that was really the beginnings. And Staten Island that you're going to talk about with Dweet is one of those properties that is part of that preserve now. It's a large working farm that you'll learn more about, where we manage it for farming and for migratory water birds. And that from that moment back in the 80s, evolving all the way to now, we've continued to invest heavily both in protecting and expanding the wetlands, the few wetlands that still exist in the valley, but also really working hard to work with the agricultural community to make it as bird friendly and wildlife friendly as possible. There's certain crops like rice that are especially valuable now that most of the wetlands are gone. And that was the origin of the Migratory Bird Conservation Partnership that Point Blue Conservation Science and Audubon California, the Nature Conservancy are all part of. And we've been working together formally as the partnership for over 10 years now to do everything I just described.
Yeah. And when we talk about California, you know, it always comes down to water. And you can't really talk about anything in California without looking at that. And you're involved in something called the Dynamic Water Management Program. And I'd like you to tell us a bit about that and how that fits into working with these agricultural interests.
Yeah. Well, so one of the real challenges we have here in California, as I'm sure you're aware, is that we've harnessed a lot of the water in California to meet the needs of people. And we've got one of the most engineered water systems on the planet, moving water from the Sierra all the way to the southern San Joaquin Valley and beyond to fuel what is one of the world's great agricultural economies and some of the biggest cities in the country. And but as a result, what we've done is remove some of the natural dynamic processes that these birds and fish depend on, the flows in the rivers, the natural pattern of water flooding out onto the landscape to create wetlands for these birds as they arrive from the Arctic or from their southern wintering zones. And so when we talk about dynamic water management, what we're referring to is trying to basically re-engineer back into what is a highly engineered system these dynamic processes that can provide just what the birds and the fish need when and where they need it the most, rather than always trying to recreate what was here before, which is probably going to be impossible, we can replace the key elements of what they need at the right times. So for example, the birds aren't here all year round. They arrive during their fall migration, and some of them as early as July, and they expand their stay through here into April. So that's when we need to deliver what they need. And they're not necessarily here in big numbers that entire time. So we can be really strategic about when and where we deliver water to meet those needs.
And Christy, could you talk a bit about what are some of the ways that ag lands can be so beneficial for the nature surrounding them?
Sure, yeah. One area we've really looked into is the supply of food, actually, that's available for shorebirds wintering in the Central Valley, or spending, it's really more than the winter, it's their entire non-breeding season, which is quite a long time from, you know, as early as Rod was saying, as early as July through April. And throughout that time, they need food every day. And the amount of habitat that's available to them to provide that food varies quite a bit throughout that time period. And so we're talking about flooded fields and wetlands that that provide access to the invertebrates in the mud underlying the water there, and really shallow water. So these are not, you know, many of these shorebirds are not very tall, and they're wading in, and they need shallow water where they can access these benthic invertebrates. And so what we've done is actually some analyses to look at how much food is available, how much habitat is available in the landscape, how much of that is flooded, how much of that is shallow and actually accessible to these birds, and estimate how much food is available on a daily basis compared to how many birds are actually in the community on any given day and how much food they need to survive each day. And we've done some analyses over the entire non-breeding season to find that the managed wetlands that we have in the system provide a good amount of that food, particularly during the fall and spring seasons that Rod was talking about, when a lot of other habitats aren't available. But during the peak of winter, really, flooded rice it makes an incredible contribution to the daily food supply of these shorebirds. And so just the practice of flooding rice fields post-harvest adds an incredible amount of habitat for these birds on top of the kind of core of managed wetland habitat that we have still left in the Central Valley.
Radha, I'm interested in how you go about connecting with the agricultural community, with the farmers that own this land, to working with them. Could you tell us a bit about, you know, how you get started with those kinds of relationships?
Yeah, that's a good question. For a long time, have had sort of working collaboratively with the agricultural sector and other unusual partners to find collaborative solutions. And in the farming sector, one advantage TNC's had is that we own quite a bit of land and actually manage a number of farmlands and grazing lands in the state. And so we have an understanding of what it takes to manage the land itself. But in the case of the kind of work we're talking about here, what we did as a partnership years ago, starting in 2008, is we began to convene workshops with rice growers and other farmers to understand what we wanted to do was communicate to them, this is what the bird needs. A lot of what Christy just said about they arrive at these times, they have a high demand for food, this is the kind of habitat they need. But we also listened to them and say, okay, well, what challenges are you facing in your management of the farms? And where's that intersection between what the birds need and what you and in the course of you running a farm can deliver? And that's where we came up with a number of practices at that time that seemed to fit well. They were sort of win-win solutions that would enable the farmers to deliver some extra habitat when it's often not available. And over the last 10 years, we've been working with them to refine those approaches, develop public incentive programs to have them implement those practices, and then more recently developing sort of private marketplace-based incentives that TNC's created, one of which is called the Bird Returns Marketplace, where we have a private marketplace where we can provide financial incentives to have them fill in these key habitat gaps that Christy was referring to.
If you're just joining us, our guests are Rod Kelsey and Kristen Dabala, and we're talking about a scientific program working with farmers in the Sacramento Delta region to enhance biodiversity, wildlife habitat, and agriculture in one of California's richest and most vulnerable growing areas. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. we're back. Let's continue now with my interview with Rod Kelsey from the Nature Conservancy and Kristen DiBala from Point Blue Conservation Science as we talk about the Sacramento River Delta region, the needs of nature, and agricultural interests. Thinking about water supply in the Delta, can you discuss with us, for people who are not really familiar with the Delta, can you explain to us how different that ecosystem is in terms of the water flow, where the water comes from? Explain to us, you know, both of you, it would be great to talk about this. How is the Delta such a unique system in California?
So the California Delta is an interesting one. It's sort of a delta in reverse. It's not like the Mississippi Delta or something like that, but it's fed by California's two great rivers, the San Joaquin River coming from the south, draining the Southern Sierra, and the Sacramento River coming from the north, draining the Northern Sierra and Southern Cascades. And historically, it was essentially a half a million acre marsh, you know, a marsh that was bigger than the existing San Francisco Bay right now. And over time, we've slowly converted that over to these islands of agriculture in the bay that are now really dependent on fresh water. And the Delta itself is tidal, it's naturally tidal. So the San Francisco Bay salt waters will push in and drain out. And now we need to maintain that fresher and less salty than it might otherwise be sometimes in order to sustain the agriculture in the Delta. Meanwhile, we're using a lot of the water upstream for agriculture, like rice and other crops. And so it's become a real challenging balance to supply the water for agriculture upstream, deliver enough fresh water into the Delta to both do the agriculture there, but also to sustain some of the ecological functions in the Delta itself, which are really dependent on that pattern of fresh and salt water salinity. And the habitats that depend on that fluctuation.
Yeah. The Delta is such a complicated place for, you know, for many reasons, but layering in the anticipated effects of climate change and sea level rise, it makes the water situation even that much more complicated. And on top of that, it's, you know, it's an, like Rod was saying, it's an incredible estuary, provides such a diversity of habitat types for birds and fish and many other wildlife. It's a place that, you know, we expect to remain one of the coolest places in the Central Valley in the future. It's a place that may become more important for a lot of these wildlife in the future under climate change. And there's so many interests in the Delta. It's really interesting to think about and complicated to think about, you know, all of the ways that conservation for wildlife can contribute to some of the many goals in the Delta for preserving the ecosystem, protecting the ecosystem, and also protecting the way of life there.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned the cooling effect of the Delta, because I live in the northern part of the Sacramento Valley, right next to the Sacramento River. It's literally less than a mile from my home. And yet it's very hot here in the summer. Whereas in Sacramento, where you're next to the Delta, you get this natural air conditioning effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It's great.
Yeah. So people at night, you know, in Sacramento, open up their windows and get, you know, that nature's air conditioning. That, and like you said, that's going to be terribly important as time goes by, as the planet warms.
Yeah, yep. Absolutely. And we think it's going to be for that reason. And because it's really the hub of the major rivers of California and the managed water system of California, that it's going to be that much more important as a place for the birds because of, you know, it's always going to be wet. Whereas during droughts like the one we're facing right now this year, which is going to be really challenging for people and nature, it's a place where you could expect to reliably deliver flooded wetlands and flooded agricultural lands that meet the needs of these migratory birds.
And what kind of agriculture do you find? Is there, what is the variety of agricultural crops and interests that are around the Delta and in the Delta? What are some of the different, you know, because I know there's definitely all kinds of crops. There's not just rice. Tell us about the different kinds of habitat that those create.
Yeah, it's a diverse place and it's changing like so many other places. Historically, it's been many things. There used to be a lot of asparagus, for example, in the Delta. There's still some, but not that much. A lot of it is corn in the Delta. And you can, when you talk to DeWeet, can talk about our growing of corn on Staten Island. But it's got increasing number of orchards and vineyards on the margins of the Delta, on the eastern, southern, and northern borders. There's a lot of alfalfa and some other, you know, row crops and things like that. But a lot of it is grain crops, which is part of what makes it a good place for birds, because it's those grain crops like rice, like corn, like wheat, that the waterfowl, the ducks and the geese, depend on for winter food. There's a lot of the grain left over after harvest that they feed on, as well as the flooding of those fields provide vital habitat for migratory birds, including sandhill cranes, which we manage for specifically at Staten Island. And then as you move out on the margins of the Delta, one of the challenges we faced is the encroachment of orchards and vineyards, which don't provide very good habitat, if habitat at all, for the migratory birds we're trying to protect.
Yeah, and the orchards also tend to pump more groundwater out of the ground than just, you know, it doesn't get used on the surface the way you would, like, say, for a rice wetland.
Yeah, exactly, which is, yeah, that flooding is what make it good habitat.
And we haven't mentioned fisheries, but let's talk a bit about the fish situation, because the Delta is also, and these agricultural areas are very important for California's fisheries.
Yes, we know the Delta is incredibly important for fish, and a lot of salmonids have to travel up through the Delta to get to their places where they can lay their eggs every year. And then species like the Delta smelt that are, of course, threatened. And, you know, it's interesting. We've been thinking a lot about how birds and fish, conservation for birds and fish, can work together. And I think there are a lot of opportunities for that. And there are some examples, you know, where we know that providing floodplain access to some of the juvenile salmon can improve their survival and their growth rates. And these are the same kinds of places that can be also great habitat for birds at the same time. So I think we still have certainly a lot to learn about how their needs can be, needs for fish and needs for these migratory birds can be met simultaneously, and to what extent there may be some, you know, trade-offs or kind of compromises between timing and flows in the rivers and things like that. But there are a lot of opportunities, I think, for goals for birds and fish to be met together.
Yeah, and Rod, in the past, there's always been this kind of black and white version of this, that you're either for the fish or against it, or for the farmers, and, you know, never the two can meet. Can you talk a bit about how the work that you're doing with the Nature Conservancy can meet the needs of both the agricultural people and the fisheries?
Yeah, that's like Chrissy said, this is, you know, the balance we're all trying to strike, and there's some real opportunities. So there's a few things that we're doing. You know, one is very traditional restoration of some key places. So one back to your original, the first question with Christy is, in the Cosumnes River Preserve, some of the things we've been doing have been actually restoring natural floodplains. So take a little bit of farmland out of production and open it up so the river can flood out onto its banks like it historically would have, which creates amazing spawning habitat and rearing habitat for these salmonids that desperately need it. And then there's some more creative solutions where we can work with the farming community to do what Christy was alluding to, which is flood farmland. And this is something we're doing in partnership, as you know, with each of us plus with Cal Trout, to see how much fish food actually we can create on the same fields we're flooding for the migratory birds. So the idea is that you could actually flood farmlands, which are now no longer connected to the river, and produce a lot of fish food and put that back in the river and have it feed the salmon that are coming out of these tributaries to the Sacramento River where they've been spawning and the babies are coming down the river. And we have great evidence now that the fish grow bigger and stronger when you do that, which makes them better able to survive their epic migration out of the delta and out into the ocean, and then ultimately come back to their spawning streams. So that's an example of some of the work we're doing to find a solution that actually works for the farmers, works for the fish, works for the birds. And we're really excited about some of the opportunities we have there.
Yeah, and you mentioned climate change earlier, and all of this also plays a really interesting role in being a carbon sink. This is also, all of these practices that you're talking about are also excellent ways to get carbon dioxide out of the air. Do you guys do much in terms of study of that?
We do. So one of the things that you can, you might talk with Dweet more about on Staten Island. So one of the things about farming in the Delta in particular is that these, because they're ancient marsh, you know, basically marsh soils that were created by eons of marsh sort of degrading and creating these highly carbon, high carbon soils, peat soils, as we call them. So they're great for farming, but when you farm them, you release a lot of carbon. Just by the function of farming. And what we've been doing is actually using eddy flux towers and other instruments to measure the greenhouse gas emission differences between growing corn in certain ways versus rice versus wetlands. And there's some other islands and partners who are doing similar work in the Delta. And one of the things that we do know now is that rice as a crop, which is a great habitat crop, is closer to net neutral. In other words, you stop emitting greenhouse gas emissions relative to growing corn or something like that. You also stop the subsidence that's having these islands sink further and further below sea level, which is increasing the risk in the Delta. And so there's a lot of interest now in how do we transition the Delta into a landscape that's carbon neutral, more resilient to floods and other risks in the future, and is bird friendly. So that's where we're trying to take our work in the Delta, is to make that kind of landscape scale transition that's about the climate as well.
So for right now, you know, how are the birds, both the resident populations and the migratory birds, how are they doing?
Well, so one of the things we learned recently is that we've experienced these catastrophic declines of birds in North America over the last 50 years. A recent comprehensive report suggested that we've lost about 3 billion birds in North America. And shorebirds, the birds that Christy was talking about earlier that we're really focused on, are some of the most rapidly declining birds. So that's why we're focused on that. The good news is that we have a great example of what's possible with the waterfowl. And the success we've shown in the Central Valley and other parts of the US, where wetland restoration and protection have actually reversed the declines of ducks and geese. And they're one of the few bird groups that are actually stabilized and doing quite well. So that's the hopeful sign that if we can add these other elements into the system, we can actually reverse what are some continuing declines in migratory bird populations.
Christy, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I'll just add that because these birds are migratory, you know, the birds that are spending the winter here in the Central Valley connect us to their nesting grounds in the Arctic, in the tundra, you know, places that are thousands of miles away. And the habitat that they experience here directly impacts how they survive the winter, how they migrate, whether they survive migration back to their nesting grounds, whether they're able to reproduce successfully, and then also migrate back on the other end. And so the decisions we make here have a direct impact on this entire life cycle. And it's kind of an awesome responsibility that we have to protect these birds, not just because they're here, but because they impact these bird populations across the entire continent.
I would like to ask you both about, and if you know about this, you know, over the years we've had the state government talking about, you know, diversion projects in the Delta and, you know, the tunnel plan. You don't probably have much control, I guess, over that, but, you know, what are your thoughts on some of the state's efforts and what they, you know, have plans to do or have had plans to do in terms of diverting water as far as the Delta goes?
That's a big question. I think our interests lie in whatever solution we, you know, develop as a state and as a society to meeting the needs of both is that, number one, nature has a voice in the solution and that we're not making the situation worse. And there's probably many ways to get that right in the Delta. And whether the devil will be in the details in the long run if tunnels were constructed, about how those are managed. I think that's going to be, if they were in place, that's going to be the key factor, because that's going to have a tremendous impact on how much fresh water is making its way into the Delta, which will have an effect on our ability to maintain habitat and for the farmers in the Delta. And also how much water is coming out of the Sacramento River, because by definition, that's about moving water out of the Sacramento Valley down to the San Joaquin Valley.
Yeah. Before I let you go, I would like to ask you both, and I'll start with you, Christy, what do you enjoy most about your work on projects like this?
I do a lot of the research work, the analysis, and the kind of computational work. And I find it really interesting when I get to, work with partners like Rod and, partners from other organizations, and to just hear about kind of their connections to these places and their, different perspectives on the landscape. And one of my, big research interests right now is this idea of multiple benefit conservation and identifying, how do different, proposals or, decisions about conservation that we're making, how do those affect the birds? Sure. But other things that we care about, the greenhouse gases and water quality and other kinds of ecosystem services and benefits that we all care about, and trying to find ways to balance those and even just understand how different decisions will affect all of those different dimensions. It's a huge challenge, but one that I find really interesting, getting to collaborate with a bunch of different people and think about a big problem in a number of different dimensions.
And Rod, what about you? What do you find most rewarding or even challenging about your work?
Yeah, I like everything Christy said. And there's a couple of things I really enjoy and get me up in the morning about this is, one is, I love knowing that we're bringing solutions to saving one of the world's great migrations, the Pacific Flyway, and just understanding and learning about what these birds need and how we can maintain a home for them. So that inspires me and in my job. But the other thing I love is coming up with creative, collaborative solutions with the farming community, with our other partners, things like bird returns, things like bird-friendly groundwater recharge, which is another one of the solutions we're trying to bring to the table that connects with your interview with Thomas Harder from UC Davis about groundwater replenishment, is we can actually do the replenishment that he was talking about that California desperately needs in ways that create habitat for birds. So coming up and institutionalizing those kinds of creative solutions so that 100 years from now, they're in place and the birds are thriving and the farms are thriving, that really excites me.
Yeah, that's great. Well, it was so good talking to both of you, and thanks for your important work on this and for sharing it with us, because it's fascinating, and it's good to hear about some of these efforts that are going on, some of the good news coming out of the ongoing struggle of nature and California. It's one of the things that we love about living in California, but it's also such a great challenge.
Yeah, it's exciting stuff, though. We really appreciate your interest. Thanks for reaching out.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thanks to our guests, Rod Kelsey from the Nature Conservancy and ecologist Kristen DiBala from Point Blue Conservation Science. When we come back, we'll talk to Dewitt Zelicki, a farmer who works with and for the Nature Conservancy at their Staten Island property, home to sandhill cranes and other wildlife in the fragile Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta system. Stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Our next guest is farmer conservationist Dewitt Zelicki. Zelicki's family immigrated to the United States from Ethiopia, and eventually Dewitt settled in Northern California, where he became an organic farmer. As we'll hear, his life dramatically changed when he was employed by the Nature Conservancy. Zelicki, who has been an organic orchardist near where I live, is one of the principal Nature Conservancy farmer scientists managing the Staten Island property owned by the environmental organization in the Sacramento River Delta region. He joins us to talk about it now. Dewitt Zelicki, welcome to Blue Dot.
Oh, thank you.
First of all, I'd like to find out a bit about your background, because you have an interesting one. Can you tell us a little bit about your origin story?
Okay. So I was born in Ethiopia. My family immigrated to New York in 1974. And then I went to high school and college in New York. And then I came out to California in 89 and proceeded to get I started farming in Davis area in winters. And then I got a job with the Nature Conservancy in 92 at the Cosumnes River Preserve. And that's a great job and a great organization. And I've been there since, almost 30 years.
And how did that come about? Weren't you doing some farming before then? Like, and how was that going?
Yes, I was living in Davis at the time, and there was a farm called Wild and Wonderful, and they were growing salad mixes, which for 1989 was a fairly new thing in California. And then we expanded it to 6 acres to a little property out in Winters, and we continued to grow organic salad mixes, cut flowers and vegetables. And, you know, it was great, but part of being organic is building up the soil and taking care of the land. And the property I was on was owned by somebody else. And I realized I'm making all these improvements and building the soil and farming organically, but I was never going to be able to own it. And so at that point, I decided to kind of look for a new adventure and do something else.
And that's how you
and
came
that's
to the...
when. Yeah, and that's how I came to the Nature Conservancy.
Well, tell us a bit about the Staten Island place. Because, you know, when most people hear Staten Island, you think of a ferry and a place in New York. Tell us about Staten Island in California.
Okay. I've never been able to find out how it got its name, Staten Island. But it is a piece of property in the San Joaquin, Sacramento Delta. It's 9,200 acres, and it's about 15 minutes off of I-5 and about 40 miles south of Sacramento, and it's in the eastern delta. And Staten Island is a very special place. It was reclaimed in the late 1800s, early 1900s, which means that people settled on it, and they built a levee to keep the river out. And they started farming it. And it has really rich peat soils, which is indicative of deltas. And ever since then, it's been farmed in different row crops. By the time the Nature Conservancy got interested in it, which was about 20 years ago, it was being farmed by a couple of wonderful managers called Jim and Sally Shanks. And they were farming for an investment property owner out of Portland, Oregon. And it was mostly in production of corn, winter wheat, alfalfa, and other, other crops that they rotated through there. And pretty soon they discovered farming it that the sandhill cranes, which is this magnificent bird, about 4 foot tall with a over 6 foot wingspan, a gray bird with a red marking over its eye, which migrates into there in the winter as part of the Pacific Flyway. They really like that island. And as the years have gone, the cranes have really established a major population there, especially as the land around Staten Island and that Walnut Grove area has gotten converted to permanent crops, grapes, almonds, walnuts, and olives. And the cranes really like it. And so do a lot of other waterfowl, because after the farming is over, after the corn has been harvested, the Shanks would flood about 20% of the island. And this was done for two reasons. One was for flushing out salts out of the soils and breaking down the stubble. And the other was for recreational hunting, which happened. And both of those attracted massive amounts of waterfowl and shorebirds. And, you know, this is really interesting because this is all part of this Pacific Flyway migration that happens through the Central Valley, all the way up from Alaska to the Oregon, Washington, the Sierras. And so all these birds come through here and overwinter. And so they would arrive at this area just as the corn was being finished harvesting and they're starting flooding up. And so they would roost in the shallow open water, which are the corn fields, and they would forage in the rest of the fields, which eating the leftover grains from the agriculture, other bugs and invertebrates and other plants they would find. And so that management, that annual farming cycle really made it really attractive for these species. And so that's how Staten Island that's how we discovered it. And so at the time we had been at the Cosumnes River Preserve, and the Cosumnes is a special river that comes right into the Delta. It's the last undammed river coming out of the Sierras and has huge floodplain. And so working our way through acquisitions and building the preserve, Staten was a general growth out of that. And so when it became up for sale, we really looked at it and we realized how valuable it is because, you know, it's a really great example of multiple land uses where you could have agriculture, you could grow food for people, and you could have wildlife habitat. And the timing really worked very well. And so we saw that as this 9,200 acre conventional farm that could grow food, employ people, be part of the local economy, and also create this great habitat in the winter. And if it worked and it continued to work, we saw it as a place that could be a really great example for other farms around the world, and especially in California. And so it's been a wonderful adventure because there's really two sides of the farm. There is the managers of Staten Island, the farmers, and then there's the conservation team that manages this, the habitat for the cranes, the waterfowl that show up in the winter. And you could imagine the farmers would like to birds to go start moving north so they could start planting as soon as they can. The conservationists, well, the birds are still here. They're not ready to migrate. So let's keep some flooded ground and let's have areas they could forage. And so there's this constant back and forth, and really an appreciation for each other's needs and the needs of the birds. And so we've created this place where we're managing it compatibly for cranes and waterfowl, but also is really a functioning, wonderful farm.
Could
Can you think of an example, a specific example of like a practice, you know, on the farm where you guys learned a lesson and decided, oh, let's do this differently, that benefited both the agriculture and the wildlife and the wildfowl?
Yes, there's one. So the way you'd flood the fields is you'd build these levees, these small levees that are 4 or 5 feet tall around the field. And then you'd pour water into the field. And so when you did that, the field would basically, the water would be deeper at the lower side and higher and lower and shallow on the top side. And so we realized we had to flood these huge pieces of fields in order to get the 4 to 6 inches that the cranes roosted in and preferred. And so at the bottom of the field, it would be 4 to 5 feet deep. And at the top, it would be mud flat. And somewhere in there at the edge was this narrow roosting area that they wanted. And so one of the farmers said, you know, instead of building these big walls, why don't we follow the contour of the fields and build these smaller walls following the contours? And so we started building these smaller walls, which created a lot more roosting habitat for the cranes, which means by following the contour, we could create 4 to 6 inch deep sections of that field in multiple areas by managing the water. And that's one of the practices we've started. The other is really how to manage your corn stubble. When the corn is harvested, there's about a 3-foot stalk that's sticking out of the ground. And we saw that made it difficult for the cranes to move around in there and forage. So one of the things we do is actually chop it and lay it down, which was allowed more grain to be accessible for the cranes, but also allowed the stalk to have contact with the soil and start breaking down sooner. And so those are kind of the practices we've been learning about.
And, you know, this year, of course, has been so very dry. How is Staten Island doing in the midst of this drought?
We're fortunate that we are surrounded by the north and south forks of the McCollumy River. And so we have water on the island, which we're able to use to flood up for the habitat. But during droughts, Staten, actually crane populations go up, and so do the waterfowl and geese, because there's so many less places that have water in them. And so we've become even more valuable in the drought years. And because when there is the big rains and the Cosumnes River floodplain pools up, and other farmers are able to flood their fields, and the refuges around Stone Lakes and Cosumnes River Preserve also can kind of have water on the ground, and state parks, when there's a lot more water, private landowners also flood their land. And so the birds disperse out during rainy season. And when their population actually during big rain years declines on Staten as they go foraging and they go roosting in other places. But in these drought years, we've become even more valuable. And that will continue to be one of the challenges for us.
Well, I'm also curious about how the diversion project that the state has planned, that possibly bypassing, you know, water through those tunnels, how could that possibly impact Staten Island? Isn't that going to pass pretty close to you?
So we talk about that change in the delta, and it's all about the fluctuation of the salt and the fresh water in the delta. And what allows us to farm where we are is we have a good quality fresh water. And so through the changes of the management of the delta, if we become more salty, it means we can't farm. But there are ways to manage that. And so the tunnel is all about how you manage it and what else you think is valuable and how you design it in a way that it could benefit all these competing uses on the land. And so it's to be determined.
Well, what's your favorite thing about your work with the Nature Conservancy and specifically about Staten Island? What's your favorite thing about it?
It's the people of the Delta to me. You know, I live up in Orland, California, near Chico. And you come into the Delta and you look different to begin with. And then you work for the Nature Conservancy and you get the look. But they have accepted, I feel I'm accepted there, that I feel, after being, you know, I was there during the 2017 flood and we were all patrolling our levees and keeping an eye on each other and each other's equipment and farms. And that really, for me, bonded me and realized here's a community that, you know, for fate has brought it to this piece of landscape and has given it the circumstance and this constantly changing world. And when you're a farmer, you know, you get approximately 40 crops in your lifetime. And that's what you strive for, to grow 40 crops. And yet there's all these issues in the Delta that happen with it. And so for me to be there when people say, what is the Nature Conservancy doing here? And what are you doing there? I could say, come on over. Let's talk about it. I want to learn from you. Let us show you what we're doing. And so I think that's been my, you know, the rewarding part of my career here.
Well, Dawid, it's been a joy to talk to you. And thanks for sharing your passion about this incredible piece of land in this fascinating place called the Delta of California, where all of the major river systems meet before they go into the Bay of San Francisco and out to the Pacific Ocean. It's just an amazing place.
Yes, come out and visit us.
Thanks again to our guests, Rod Kelsey and Dawid Zielicki from the Nature Conservancy and Kristen Dabala from the Point Blue Conservation Science Organization. Special thanks to Juvenio Guerra from the Nature Conservancy for assisting with setting up these interviews. And if you've never been to the Delta region of California, I highly recommend you visit it, especially during the fall and winter months when migratory birds are at their peak. It's beautiful. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. You can share this program or check out past episodes and subscribe to our podcast at mynspr.org, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.